Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Joanne Folletta. She's in town to conduct the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia in two concerts. She also conducts a new CD of works by the late great Philadelphia composer Romeo Cascarino. Susan Lewis visits Look Again, an exhibition at the Rosenbach Museum and Library. We examine the fate of artists and arts organizations who lose their workspaces to accommodate the expansion of the Pennsylvania Convention Center. We speak with Opera Company of Philadelphia Managing Director David Devan about the company's co-commissioning of a brand new opera for next season. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we speak with architect Bernard Sawinski, the creator of the Liberty Bell Center. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Last March, a project to record orchestral works by the late Philadelphia composer Romeo Cascarino got underway at the First Presbyterian Church in Germantown, Philadelphia. The project was instigated by Tom DiNardo. It's not the first time the Daily News arts writer and WRTI contributor has taken an active part in bringing Cascarino's work to a wider audience. In 1982, he helped commission a performance of the opera William Penn at the Academy of Music. For this latest recording on the Naxos label, DiNardo raised the money to put together the Philadelphia Philharmonia, an orchestra comprised mainly of musicians from the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. He also convinced Joanne Folletta, music director of the Virginia Symphony and the Buffalo Philharmonic, to conduct the work. I met with Miss Folletta during recording sessions and first asked how she had reacted when she first heard the music of Romeo Cascarino.
I was astonished by it. And the first thing that I ever heard was Pygmalion. That's the first thing I played. And I said to myself, why isn't this known? And why aren't people playing this? And it made me realize how a beautiful voice can be forgotten or can be lost somehow or overlooked. And that didn't seem right. And I think Tom and others felt exactly that same way, that it shouldn't be. People deserve to play this music and know this music.
But you're also now in a rather odd situation, having made the decision that this was worthy of effectively creating the signature recording for this music, if, and we hope it'll be the case, that other people choose to take it on. How much liberty does it give to you as a music maker to interpret this music?
You know, it's an interesting situation, and it's a difficult one as well, because since Romeo's no longer alive, all we have are his notes on the paper and the directions that he gives us. But that's very incomplete. You know, it's as if we, you know, reading Shakespeare is so different and with the voice and the acting of one person as opposed to another. So there's a great deal of room for interpretation. And I think the conductor has to find a midpoint where you always honor what the composer has as much as we can, as much as we can tell from what he left us. And then you bring your own sense of who you are as a musician to that. But the composer always comes first, but I think every composer, the ones that I've always spoken to, want the performers to bring themselves to it as well, because that's what music is. It's fluid, it changes, it's different. And the wonderful thing will be is this disc comes out and other people hear it and play the music, they'll do it in a different way. They'll choose their own tempos, maybe a little different, their own balances, their own approach to things. And I think he would have been thrilled by that, because that's what music should be. It should be constantly alive and constantly changing. So we tried as much as possible to be true to what he wanted. We had the unusual situation in which he had recorded some of these pieces on piano himself. So that was a big clue to me about his sense of structure, his sense of momentum, how he felt about the propulsion of the piece and how it fit together. But of course, I had to weigh into that the fact that now, you know, 70 people were playing it instead of a piano. And all of a sudden, colors come into play, the different colors of an orchestra and the different strands that are knit together in a symphony orchestra, and take that into consideration. But those recordings were very helpful. And there's something eerie about hearing a composer speak to you through their performances when they're no longer around. But they've left this record, even if it's not with a symphony. So piecing all of that together, his piano recordings, the scores themselves and what he tells us about them, people who did remember him and knew of his personality, knew of his approach and his philosophy about music. That was all a great help.
On that note, when you looked at these scores, I'm assuming that you hear things in your head as you read for the first or second time. How different was it when you had, as you say, 70 live musicians putting their personality to it? How much did it change as the recording process went forward?
You know, it does change. It's almost like seeing something in black and white and then seeing it in color. I think maybe that's the best way to see it. When you're listening in your head to the score, you hear a great deal of it, but somehow the true texture is not there. It's somehow one proportion, one dimension in a way. And then when the musicians play it, yes, you're hearing them play the notes that you heard in your head, but with their personality, with their timbre, with their sound, with their tone color, it's as if all of a sudden it's in color.
An excerpt from Blades of Grass by Romeo Cascarino from a recently released CD on the Naxos label, Joanne Folletta conducting the Philadelphia Philharmonia. Folletta conducts the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia in concert in a program featuring works by Ellen Taft's Village, Dvorak, Mozart, Vaughan Williams and Stravinsky tomorrow afternoon and on Monday evening at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The current exhibition at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia attempts an integrated approach to the telling of African-American history. Showcasing some long-held objects from its familiar collection, the museum urges visitors to consider them from a different perspective, to, as the show's title suggests, look again, as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports.
Abraham and Philip Rosenbach didn't set out to collect items with significance to African-American history. From 1903 to 1953, the Rosenbach Company, with shops in New York and Philadelphia, sold American arts, antiques, and rare books. Soon after the brothers died in the early 1950s, the Rosenbach Museum opened in their Philadelphia townhouse. In recent years, the museum's work with the largely African-American population of the Philadelphia School District caused it to re-examine its American history collection. Education Director Bill Adair says they realized that many objects had as yet untold tales, and that the stories of America and African Americans are inextricably intertwined. Many items in the collection could be reinterpreted through the lens of the African American experience.
So we have a wonderful collection of mahogany furniture made in America and in England. We've always interpreted that furniture in terms of who used it. We're interpreting that furniture for the first time in terms of the fact that it's made of mahogany and it was harvested by slave labor.
To help illuminate these stories, the Rosenbach brought in Diane Turner, former curator of the African American Museum, as the consulting curator.
I wanted to start in Africa. Africa is important when you talk about African American history or the African American experience because that is where the humanity comes from.
The exhibition includes a map of Africa and explores ideas about its civilization and tradition. It moves on to slavery and the resistance mounted by people from both African American and other traditions. The exhibition consciously resists simplifying or categorizing the participants in this history.
There is no one view, one perspective of American history. Just as you have enslaved Africans, you have women like Fanny Kemble, who was married to a slaveholder. She sees how enslaved Africans are treated and doesn't like it. Then he brutally beats her in front of enslaved Africans for meddling. So once again, we're telling people to look again.
Because the Rosenbachs weren't trying to tell this story, the collection reflects a white perspective as much as it does the African-American experience. But there are exceptions, says Bill Adair, as in the case of the very first book published by an African-American.
A poet named Phyllis Wheatley, who was an enslaved African. She was kidnapped, brought to America, sold when she was about 8 years old to a family in Boston. Learned to read and write English really fast, as well as Greek and Latin, and began immediately writing poetry. And she published her first book when she was 20.
There are original notes of Abraham Lincoln mulling the question of whether to recruit African Americans to fight for the Union, and a draft of the resolution for the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. The exhibition also includes manuscripts of contemporary Philadelphian Lorene Carey, author of The Price of a Child, the first book chosen in the Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia program in 2003. And a wall-sized blackboard outside the gallery invites visitor comments. Because the purpose of the show is not just to lay out a story, but to engage people and challenge their assumptions about one another, something especially important in today's world, says Turner.
If we can deconstruct some of these stereotypes, we see that we have more similarities than differences. And if we can do that on a national level, then globally it puts us in a better position to do it with other individuals also.
The exhibition, Look Again, runs through February 25th at the Rosenbach Museum and Library on Delancey Street in Philadelphia.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. As the Pennsylvania Convention Center readies for expansion, some Philadelphia arts organizations wonder what the future holds. The Convention Center expansion will stretch from 13th Street to Broad and from Arch to Race Streets, an area that includes the 1300 block of Cherry Street. The industrial but at the same time somehow quaint block is just on the fringe of Center City, in an area that up until a couple of years ago was considered seedy and a little dangerous. This made it an ideal place for artists to find affordable rents yet stay close to Center City. In the middle of this block is the Gilbert Building. It's large and without frills, there's no doorman and two sporadically working elevators, and it's been home to arts organizations and artist studios for the past 15 years at affordable rents. The threat of the Convention Center expansion has been looming for most of those years, and as Gail Issa, Executive Director of the Asian Arts Initiative, says, the organizations were always aware of this.
We definitely have known or heard rumors, almost since the time we moved into this building, that it was slated for demolition and that the Convention Center expansion was going to happen. In some ways, it was hard to believe those rumors until in 2005, the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance had helped convene a meeting to talk about what was going to happen, especially to the arts groups. He made it very clear that the Convention Center expansion was moving forward and that we needed to work on figuring out a plan in order to ensure our own survival.
But time passed and they remained in the building. Exhibitions were planned, programs continued, and no deadline to leave came. In addition to keeping organizations active, there was a simple financial reason not to rush the move. In order to receive a relocation stipend from the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority, approximately $10,000 for each group, they had to wait to get an official eviction notice. This came in October. It ordered all the groups to be out by next Thursday, January 11th, giving them just 90 days to find new homes, renovate new spaces, and move. The Fabric Workshop and Museum is the largest entity in the Gilbert Building. Their situation is unique in many ways, one being that they've got somewhere to go. An anonymous donor has purchased a building at 1214 Arch Street. The museum will still pay rent, but the cost is significantly less than if they had to pay market value for the property. For the Asian Arts Initiative, keeping momentum has also been a priority. Much of their programming is with teens from the Chinatown community, and leaving them with nowhere to go would be a blow to the organization's mission, as would moving out of the area to a more affordable location. Last fall, State Representative Dwight Evans awarded a grant of $500,000 to help finance a permanent home for the Asian Arts Initiative and the other organizations displaced by the convention center expansion. Vox Populi is an 18-year-old artist collective housed in the Gilbert Building. Executive Director Amy Adams says she feels it's important to the gallery's mission to stay in Center City.
We're a very established resource for the arts community here and for emerging artists. And part of what we do is provide access for visiting curators and other people in the art community to come. And I don't think they're going to come to North Philly. I don't think they're going to go to South Philly.
Happily for Vox Populi, they have now found a home in Center City, Philadelphia, at 319 North 11th Street. They plan to leave the Gilbert Building at the end of this month and be open in their new location in March. Arts and culture is widely recognized as an important asset for residents of and visitors to a city. An unfortunate truth is that when neighborhoods get more economically desirable, the individual artist and smaller arts organizations are often priced out. According to Joe Goldblatt, senior lecturer at Temple University's School of Tourism and Hospitality Management, this shouldn't have to be the case.
Providence, Rhode Island is a perfect example. One block from the Rhode Island Convention Center is the Arts District, in which the City of Providence provides low rental housing and studio space for artists. This is something that the City of Philadelphia might consider as well.
The final exhibition at the Fabric Workshop and Museum, Process and Collaboration, celebrating 12 years at 1315 Cherry Street, ends today. Farewell 1315 Cherry Street at Vox Populi opened yesterday and runs through January 28th. And the Asian Arts Initiative also has a full calendar of events throughout this month, with plans to remain in the Gilbert Building through May. Following the success of last year's production, Margaret Garner, the Opera Company of Philadelphia has commissioned a brand new opera for its forthcoming season. The all-new work is called Cyrano. It's based on Edmond Rostand's late 19th century play Cyrano de Bergerac, which has been the subject of several films, stage adaptations, ballets, and even a couple of other operas. With music by Michigan Opera Theatre General Director David DeChiara and libretto by Bernard Uzan, the Philadelphia presentation will feature recent Academy of Vocal Arts graduates tenor Stephen Costello and soprano Evelyn Pollock. I spoke with the opera company's managing director David Devan earlier this week and first asked him about why they had decided to take on the production of yet another new American opera.
We've had a long conversation over the last period of time about what it really means to be an opera company and to produce a range of work that will not only appeal to a wide audience, but will serve our genre well and allow for a deeper connection with the community. So there are a lot of ways we do that. For example, our casting practices in terms of really supporting emerging talent is a really consistent theme. So when you look at our recent commitments to contemporary repertoire and American repertoire specifically, it's an outgrowth of that strategy. I mean, composers and creators of opera require the same nurturing and support as vocal talents or performing talents. So it was really within that context that the discussion happened. And it's about finding a balance. I mean, we produced Susanna, which is an existing piece, but still an American piece. We're doing Porgy and Bess this year. So there's a wide palette to explore. And Margaret Garner was a big risk because it was the biggest resource production that we had done and was completely unknown, which made it different than Susanna and Porgy and Bess, certainly.
But a lot of star power to prop it up. I mean, you had Toni Morrison, Richard Danielpour, then an amazing cast. Not going that route this time. It's from somebody who hasn't got a track record.
That's right.
And from a cast that's less well-known.
That's right. Well, we hope they will become more known. We are really thinking that for Marion Popp and Evelyn Pollock and Stephen Costello in particular, that this will be a star platform for them. The music is written in a way that is perfect for their talents. And so it's the inverse of what Margaret Garner was, in that we hope that this will be a star platform. And when you really start thinking about new work, we can't put it off into the side, oh, it needs star power to be worth its weight. It's work that stands on its own or it doesn't. Margaret Garner, it was a very wise and prudent thing to do because it was our first foray in recent years into an actual new work that was an unknown thing. And with that track record in place a little bit, I think it gave us a little more freedom for a wider casting net.
Just a final question. How does this new production mesh then with the other productions that you're doing in the forthcoming season?
Again, we're trying to produce a broad palette. So this, which is a very lyrical and melodic piece, will fit well with some other pieces of standard rep that we are producing. We will be producing a German piece as well as two Italian pieces, which we'll be announcing shortly. So this fits quite well because this will be in French. So it will have a broad set of experiences, so it's not an all-Italian season, and we thought that was really great positioning.
Opera Company of Philadelphia Managing Director David Devan. Cyrano opens in Philadelphia on February 8, 2008, and David Devan says we should expect the company to carry on this new tradition of commissioning and producing new work in future seasons. Cyrano is a co-production with Michigan Opera Theatre and Florida Grand Opera and will join three other soon-to-be-announced classic operas in the Opera Company of Philadelphia's 07-08 season. Now it's time for our regular perusal of the Culture File section of gophila.com. The most visited tourist attraction in Philadelphia is, not surprisingly, the Liberty Bell Center. The bell was moved from a pavilion on Market Street, where it had resided since the bicentennial, to its new home on 6th Street between Market and Chestnut Streets in October 2003. The Liberty Bell Center incorporates three discrete but physically and thematically connected elements: a shaded outdoor arcade containing educational materials, an inside interpretive exhibit hall, and a new chamber for the bell. The architect for the project was Philadelphia native Bernard Sawinski of Boland Sawinski Jackson.
The design process, by its nature, puts the architect in the role of a visitor. When we started out assimilating the ingredients of the center with its exhibitry, with its needs for clarity of circulation, for its staffing requirements, everything that goes into a building of this nature, you always put yourself in the position of a first-time visitor to experience this in a way that enhances that potential. What is unique about the building is that it's what we call a one-way building. You enter at the north end, you go through an exhibit, you arrive at the bell for what is the consummate experience of you and the bell in silence, and then move on to further experiences to the south as you exit. That allowed the building to have a very simple diagram of how people would use it. Visitors come in all shapes and sizes and intellectual curiosity. Some people want their picture by the bell and get on the bus, so that's what we call the three-minute visitor. But there are other guests that come to visit who are interested in the finest detail, and they may stay there for an hour poring over the text and the artifacts and the exhibitry, and come to the bell and ponder its significance based on that exposure. So we constructed what we called the fast lane and the slow lane, so to meet these two extremes of the agenda. And you can imagine people with a mixed interest can pick their path in between the two. So on one hand, it's a very serious journey, and one could learn a great deal about history and the significance of the bell. But one can also take it as a visit of great pleasure and still get the message of its importance. The way this fast lane, slow lane works is that in the organization of the building, we introduced a undulating stone wall whose purpose was in the building to separate open spaces from enclosed spaces like the multipurpose room or the special area for the Park Service, and to guide you from one set of exhibits to another to reach the ultimate destination and then out again into the landscape, so that as a visitor you can easily acclimate yourself to the opportunities. By the building being as transparent as it is, one could begin to understand the building just by walking the lawn outside. And there was a desire on our part to make this a kind of 24/7 pavilion that at night when the building was closed, that it would be lit and people could walk in the lawn and see the artifacts and the bell from this vantage point out on the lawn. All these things came together to define the enclosure of the building and the nature of this great stone wall that came through. Why is it a stone wall at all? because we were interested in resonating with the materials and the detailing of the hall as a part of the instincts for the new building or the inspiration for the new building. And as you know, the coins or the corners of Independence Hall are trimmed in the stone. It's called Chelmsford granite, and it's a American granite from Vermont that we used on our wall as well. So there's a harmony of using those two. We also use the same brick bonding arrangement. There's a Flemish bond is a pattern of bricks that deal with long and short bricks, to be simplistic about it. That is the way the facade of the hall is constructed. We use the same Flemish bond on our brickwork, and even down to the detail of the mortar that holds the bricks together, they use what is called a grapevine tooling, which is how the shape of the mortar between bricks. And it provides for a nice light seam of mortar with a shadow line in that, which makes it for a very elegant wall. We use that same detail in the new building. So we have a building that resonates with the authenticity of the past, the craft of the past, but also uses it in new and modern ways that can bring into the total equation contemporary needs for environmental controls and viewing flexibility and all those other criteria that one runs into. As I walk through the building, it's always a pleasure to see how people, where they stop, what they talk about when they're viewing the different exhibits, how fast they move through the exhibits, what happens at the threshold of the encounter to the bell, and what happens right at the bell. And it changes day to day and crowd to crowd, because on a school day, it's a very exciting, stimulating place, and kids are wired. You know, they're running around, they're having a good time, and they are connected with all of this. And but it's very interesting at the when they reach the bell, after they have this story around them, they learn by osmosis and reading that they stand at the foot of the bell, there's a magnetic distance between you and the bell that you automatically stop at a given point in the chamber. The chamber is composed of a low, I'll call it an introductory space, and then it blossoms into this large volume that centers on the on which the bell is centered. And people stay right at that edge between the low and the high space and look at the bell.
Architect Bernard Sawinski of Bolin Sawinski Jackson, the creator of the Liberty Bell Center in Philadelphia. More information on the Liberty Bell Center is available at the Culture Files section of gophila.com. And that's it for now. Our program was written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.